All right, guys, welcome back to another episode of Persuasion by the Pint. I'm Jonathan Taylor, along with
Sean McCool from the lower Antarctic region of Texas.
Are you guys thawing out? I mean,
yeah, seriously, it broke. All the power's back on for the most part. We didn't lose power, thank God, but most of the state, half the state did. It sounds like it's raining outside, but the sun's shining. But, you know, in the trees with the snow melting, it sounds like it's raining.
Yeah.
The gutters are going. We had like 6 or 8 inches of snow between our last episode and this one in Austin, Texas. Del Rio, Texas got 12 inches of snow.
Wow.
That's on the border.
Yeah. Del Rio.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
So, yeah, we just got above freezing today after 6 or 7 straight days. So, yeah, good to be thawing out. Heading into spring, hopefully.
Yep. You guys just, you guys aren't used to
it. Colder. Yeah, I know it's colder in a lot of other places. The houses are not built for it. The pipes are not buried as deep. Like, all kinds of stuff. Just the trickle effect. It was crazy. So,
I know.
Yeah, man. I think we're good. I'm excited today, man, for today's show.
Yeah, we've got a great guest joining us. I'll let you do the honors of introducing him. Today's topic, we're going to, what's the topic? We're going to talk about writing story-based
emails out of thin air.
Out of thin air.
You know, just make them up.
That's right.
That kind of thing.
That's right.
And some people will be like, I can't do that. But that's why we have a guest on today that's going to help kind of talk about how that happens. So,
yeah.
I ran across this guy on one of those, you know, those annoying Facebook ads that you get in your feed. He was running one of those, but it was really good. So I clicked on it. And then next thing you know, I'm on his list buying his product. I was going to say,
how often have you bought from those annoying Facebook ads? Cause I can
more often than I can say, care to admit, you know, they say salespeople are the easiest people to sell.
That's right.
You know, but yeah, it was really good, and I enjoy his emails. So I reached out to him, and I was like, hey, why don't you be on the show? And he said yes, because he didn't know what we do.
Sure.
So he was like, well, they got a show. I'll be on it. he may regret the decision later. That's all right. That'll be a story for his emails.
That's right. Absolutely.
Why not to accept just any old podcast invitation?
Yep.
And then turn it into whatever he turns it into. So yeah, I don't have a lot of background on Bill other than he writes really good emails that make me want to buy stuff.
I got to tell you, the copy, because I've went to his site over at Story Sales Machine, and we'll mention that again, I'm sure, before the end of the show, but really good copy from start to finish.
So why don't we just, I do believe Bill is going to bring a beer on with this. So why don't we just bring on Bill Mueller?
There we go.
With a round of applause, everybody.
All right, Bill, I love that shirt. Even though I don't drink Budweiser, I love that shirt.
You know what? I don't either. I'm wearing it out of irony and nostalgia.
There you go.
That's it. That's what sells these days, nostalgia, right?
That's either like a well-done graphic, you know, the vintage look, or it's actually vintage. Which is it?
It's the fake variety, I think.
Okay.
I bought this years ago. I want to say I was in a thrift shop, but it's, I don't think it's truly old.
Okay. That's all good. So welcome to the show. Welcome to Persuasion.
Yeah. Thank you guys. Listen to a few of your episodes. I love what you're doing and good to meet you.
Yeah. Cool. So what we usually do, Bill, is we kick off the show kind of talking about the beer of choice for each of us. And, we'll let our guests go first. I think you said you were going to choose between an IPA and a stout. So I got my fingers crossed for one or the other. But
yeah, I'm aware that I've heard enough to know that one of you guys doesn't like IPAs.
Yeah.
That would be both of us.
Oh, what's your problem with IPAs?
Just never really developed that taste for the flowers, drinking flowers.
Too sour. Yeah.
Right on. I do have a stout, so you'd be happy about that.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And nice. I just, you know, I was shopping yesterday for what I wanted and I found a local brewery. All these words, talking about good copy, all the words on the label I liked. Mocha, stout, coffee, limited.
It's got all the keywords we like. Coffee, mocha, espresso, chocolate.
What did go wrong? But this is from a local brewery called Black Raven. I'm in the Seattle area.
Oh, okay.
And we discovered this brewery because You can YouTube this sometime. There's a crazy event that happens every day here. About 50,000 or more crows migrate from downtown Seattle to a town called Bothell, which is maybe 20 miles away. And they just gather in this one grove of trees every single day at sunset. And I guess at sunrise, they go back. And me and my wife go watch them sometimes. And so we that happened to trigger our radar for Black Raven Brewery, which is only a few miles away. So we became fans. And next thing you know, I got a stout, day drinking with a stout.
I love it. Love it. So you're actually in, I think you're in Kirkland, right? Is that what I saw? Yeah. So our one of my buddies, RC, who was on a couple episodes ago, he's right there in Kirkland as well. He's yeah, have to introduce you two guys.
Yeah, for sure.
So that happens every day. That's pretty interesting. Yeah. Every day.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, when they come in, the sky is just black with crows. It's crazy. Yeah. All in the span of about 20, 30 minutes. And wow. They just nest in the trees. The sound is more amazing than the visual because on video, you can't really capture the visual that well.
Yeah.
But there's actually, it's so compelling that people have filmed YouTube informational videos about it. I don't, you know, completely understand it, but it's crazy.
Yeah, we just have bats here in Austin, but not every day. It's like, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 months out of the year. They come out from under the Congress Street Bridge, like 1.5 million bats at sunset. They go off, eat their bugs and come back. Yeah, it's like everybody lines up on the bridge from, I think, August. I think that's when it starts, is like August. And it's crazy. Like, it's just like same thing. The sky just kind of turns black with bats.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild. So, well, let's see the label on that, yeah. Cause that's how we judge beer. We just use the label. So
that's right. Creativity.
Yeah. StreamYard video is backwards.
There you go.
There
Black
you go.
Raven Stout.
Oh, Feather Weather Stout. I like that play on words there. Yeah. It's good stuff. It's very like traditional kind of classical looking can. I like it.
Yeah.
Excellent.
What are you guys drinking? Or am I drinking alone?
No, we're drinking.
Sean may be drinking whiskey. No,
not this week. No. So I've got another craft beer club, original craft beer club beer. So Zipline Brewery up in, where were they from? Lincoln, Nebraska. So this is our subscription service. That's our sponsor, Bill. So we talk about some of their beers. So you get a box of beer on your front porch, like once a month. Pretty cool All deal. Right. And you can find out more at persuasionbythepint.com/craft beer. So this one is, like I said, from Lincoln, Nebraska, Zipline Brewery. It's a German style Kolsch. I don't know how to say that properly. Kolsch. All right. It's 5.4% ABV, 24 IBUs. Here's the copy on it. A refreshing ale that drinks like a lager. The Zipline German style Kolsch pours straw yellow in color with hints of honey malt character and a smooth, crisp finish. This easy drinking Kolsch is brewed with Magnum and Tatang hops, Pils and Munich malts, and local organic white wheat. So best
Magnum
enjoyed at
and
30.
Tatang. Tatang.
Yeah. Best enjoyed at 38 degrees. Huh? Yeah, that's a lot of stuff in there, right? Yeah, some of the combinations they put in here are pretty amazing. So this is basically a lager is what they're saying. So looking forward. What do you got there, Jonathan?
I have a Totality Imperial Stout from 50-50 Brewing Company. So this is a first for a 50-50 Brewing Company on our show. We've never had their beer, so try it out. It is.
So does that mean like half the beers are good and half are bad? It's a 50-50 shot? I mean, it seems like an odd name for a...
So this is an award-winning Imperial Stout. It serves as the base beer for our international acclaimed Barrel Age Eclipse. Never had that one. Let's see. Rich, dark chocolate, mocha, and espresso flavors. 9.5 ABV.
So yours is just fermented a little bit longer than Bill's, but should be the same basic taste.
Let's see.
Sounds like.
Ooh, it looks good. It looks really good.
Yeah, so y'all got the dark beers, and I've got the...
That was a bad pour on my part, but...
Yeah. All right. Well, cheers, everybody.
Cheers.
Oh, that's all right. Pretty good.
We'll let Bill go first. So, Bill, we have a rating from 1 to 5 pints, and you can go like, you don't have to make it a whole number.
One decimal place, though. Don't get crazy.
This is a 4.5.
Oh, wow.
Nice. Very nice.
Yeah, this is good.
Excellent. So you went straight to the bottle, so that's good. Must be good. So mine is actually surprisingly good. Like, I was not expecting that at all. It does definitely have, you know, it said hints of honey malt. Like, I definitely get that, a little bit of sweetness from it.
Yep.
This is really good. I'm going to, this will probably be my highest discolored beer ever. I'm going to give it a, 4.75. Sorry, I went two decimal places.
4.75. Wow.
Yeah, it's good. It's
getting really exact.
It's like what a, what I would expect like a quality lager to taste like. I mean, it's just, it's good. Very good. All right, Jonathan, what you got there on your Imperial?
I'm going to give this an even 3. The aftertaste is a little, not to my liking. The initial taste is really good. It's not too sweet. I don't know what the aftertaste is, but it's not so great. I'll just keep drinking.
Yeah. Typically those stronger stouts, like they, as they kind of air out in the glass, they tend to, I think they get smoother.
It's almost like a Guinness-y aftertaste. So,
yeah. All right. Welcome to the show. I've been looking forward to this all week. And, I, like I said, I got an email from you today. I don't know if you wrote that today or if that's part of a sequence, how to write the story-based email out of thin air. And, it's about the roses, if that jogs your memories.
Yeah. That's a broadcast. Okay. It's not installed in an autoresponder.
Okay.
So, cool.
I thought that was a good example of what I believe that you do, like just kind of the way you laid that out and how you came up with it and those kind of things. But before we get into that, kind of give us some background of how you, I always love hearing the kind of the winding road that gets people into copywriting, mm-hmm. And then direct response copywriting on top of that. So how'd you get from wherever to where you are today?
Basically I started off in the world of small town journalism.
Okay.
So, wore a few different hats there, reporter, editor, sports editor, columnist. So I banged around in some different small newspapers, did some freelance newspaper and magazine writing, and got into copywriting. Basically, I helped, the first thing I did is going to show you how old I am. I was on AOL. All great stories start with I was on AOL. I was teaching a class. Do you guys know what the Learning Annex is? I don't know if you have that where you are. It's an educational franchise where adult education. Yep. And I was teaching a class to seniors on how to write their memoirs. And so I was on AOL. And AOL at that time, you had the ability to just email or message people based on keywords, the entire database. So I wrote this sales letter. I'm trying to rack my brain how I discovered how to write a sales letter, but I wrote a letter out to a bunch of seniors on how to write their memoir. And I actually got people to send me checks through the mail just on sending instant messages through AOL.
Wow.
So I was getting checks in the mail to help them write their memoirs. And that's when a light bulb kind of went on. And then a few years later, I helped a buddy of mine, one of my basketball friends, write a book, which turned into a full-time business for about 9 years, selling a multimedia program to basically classroom teachers who were having trouble with disruptive kids. So I learned all about internet marketing that way.
Sure.
Jim Edwards was one of the first guys I followed, him and Joe Vitale. Mm-hmm. Just learned a lot about direct response that way and just kind of, you know, learned that way. That was almost 20 years ago.
I was going to say AOL had to be what, 97, 98, 99, somewhere in there.
Yeah. I think I hit the eject button on AOL in the maybe 98, 99. I can't let go of the email address because it's my name at AOL.com.
Sure.
And I can't get any other online property with just my name. So I've hung on to it for free, but.
Yeah. Wow. So to start out, so you had a little bit of a, I don't know, a knack, but you usually, if you go into journalism, there's, you kind of enjoy writing a little bit. Is that true? Or is that an assumption on my part? Incorrect.
That is an assumption. I enjoy having finished writing.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Just, you know, a lot of, I'm jealous of people that find writing fun. Mm-hmm. If I'm sitting down to write something that's like personal or fun, like say I'm writing somebody a letter, which, you know, doesn't really happen anymore, but I enjoy working with words, but I can't say writing is fun for me.
But
I like having written something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I totally get it. Especially paid writing, right? Because then the demons come out. Like if nobody's paying you for it, it's a lot easier. Mm-hmm. But if you either want it to be read, or you think it's going to be read, or you're going to be paid for it, the demons definitely come out at that point. So
plus having deadlines.
If I get a text coming in and I feel like I can write something in two or three sentences that just like really hits it, or an email, that's like fun for me.
Sure.
But if I have to sit down and write some copy, I'm not saying it's not fun, but it's more of a chore. Yeah. And mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's work.
Is the chore starting, or is it like once you get going, do you feel you get in a pretty quick groove, or is it just?
Yeah, no, there is something to the fact once you get warm and into it. I liked what Hemingway said. You know, Hemingway used to, he used to finish his day's work, he said, in the middle of a sentence, so that when he returned to it, he could return to it warm, so to speak.
Right.
I always kind of like that. Rather than finishing a full chapter, then you're starting from scratch and cold.
Sure. Yep.
So,
I've heard the same thing. Like if you edit yesterday's work before you start writing, you kind of get those juices flowing as well.
Yeah.
You know, maybe edit the last two or three pages. For some people, that doesn't work because it's two different parts of your brain really editing.
Yeah. And you know what? I'm one of those people that does something that's not really recommended. I edit a lot as I go along. Everyone says, oh, just blow through the rough draft. I don't know if it's perfectionism. I have a hard time doing that. I've got one, you know, the writing hand and the editor hand. The editor hand's got a hold on the writing hand. And
I think part of that is just word processor. You know, you've been able to use, you know, docs and things like that. It's just so easy to do that. Whereas before, if you had a typewriter, but even when I sit down and write by longhand every once in a while, because, you know, I just try to do something different, I still find myself like scratching out and starting over. So I guess I'm the same way. I edit as I go.
It's tough when you've got that that red line automatically that appears when you're writing, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You got to like correct that thing right away. It's so distracting. Yeah.
You know, Sean, you gave me something to think about. This is how old I am. When I got my first journalism job, I literally was typing away on a manual typewriter. Yeah. So you had to really think about what you hammered out before it, you know, you could make changes after that, but, and maybe that's where it comes from. I also remember, Tom Robbins, the novelist who I guess is from up here. He basically wrote his novels in one draft. He would write one sentence, make sure it's perfect, and move on to the next one. I'm not that bad.
Yeah.
Wow.
Apparently all his novels were written, or so I once read, in one draft.
Wow. Probably a long draft, though, as far as like time to compile. That seems to me that would just be painstaking. Kind of goes against what Anne Lamott talks about and just kind of letting your writing flow out and, you know, then going back and fixing it later, you know? So
how long did you write for your local, like these local newspapers? How long did you do
that? Yeah, I did that, you know, probably about 15 years.
Okay.
Yeah. So you've been doing some type of direct response copy for, you said like 20 years now.
Yeah.
Wow. So you're part of the old guard.
Yeah. Yeah.
These days.
So what's the biggest takeaway from that? Because I know, you know, newspapers, you know, you're always on a deadline. So would you say that, you know, from your experience in the newspaper business, is that one of the biggest lessons or one of the biggest strengths that you take into copywriting is just the fact that you've learned, you know, that time that gave you those, you know, you had those automatic deadlines that you had to meet? And I'm sure it's like coming out of the military. You know, Sean and I would talk about, you know, we've been out of the military for a long time, but there's still some things that are just kind of ingrained in our DNA from that. You know, I'm sure as a journalist, there's some things that, like, you know, just automatically you bring to the table when you're a copywriter.
No, for sure. In fact, a deadline in journalism is a real deadline.
Yeah.
I mean, back in the day, if I covered a game and I'm sitting in the press box, literally the truck for the printing press is waiting in the newspaper for your copy.
Yeah.
And there's people back in Paced Up that are doing their thing. The truck will leave without you if you're not finished. And there almost could be a hole in the paper if you don't finish. It's not quite that dramatic, but sure. It's a real deadline. Whereas when you're doing work for clients, yeah, there's deadlines. And I take them seriously, but you know, there's different kinds of deadlines, but yeah, that always, mm-hmm. you know, started with me and probably did instill some discipline.
Yeah. And do you think, what else do you think is beneficial that you brought? So for me, my background was like, I've been in door-to-door sales. I've been in in-home sales. So obviously that translated to my copywriting experience, but what from journalism, what else did you take that you think helped you in the direct response world? Cause a lot of guys are getting into copywriting and they don't have much background. They're getting in it cause it's kind of the make money thing and
right.
you know, the hot career opportunity and kind of that. What transferred really well from journalism to copy?
I would say the word that comes to mind is precision. You have to be precise, whether it's quoting somebody accurately, whether it's getting the right spelling of somebody's name, mm-hmm. Whether it's accurately describing a product. You have to get it right because there's people out there. I've had this pretty funny story. I wrote a story for the paper once. Roger Revell is a guy who basically is credited with inventing global warming. He was at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. I was working for a paper in La Jolla, California at the time. And it turns out I made a mistake in the paper. I misquoted his wife, I believe it was. Where I attributed a quote his wife said to someone else. He comes storming into the office, blows past the receptionist, dresses me down in front of all my colleagues. I'm in my early 20s. I'm blushing red as Christmas. And it just brings it home that when you write something for the public and it's out there in the newsstand and people are reading it, if you're wrong, you hear about it and it can have consequences. So, you know, was it Ezra Pound who said that the one sole morality of writing is fundamental accuracy of statement? Well, you got to be damn sure that the product you're writing about or the promise you're making has some accuracy to it, because, you know, there's some wiggle room in marketing. We all take liberties with the way things are phrased. But I guess I took that, to answer your question, I took that from journalism, that you've got to be precise and that words matter and facts matter and double check things.
Yeah, that's a great point. Because there's definitely some sloppy writing and citations and things like that these days, not just in copy and just in general, in media, everywhere. Yeah. So let's jump back to today, Bill, and kind of give me your description or give the audience your description of what it is you do today as far as copy. You kind of narrowed down to your thing. How would you describe what you do today?
Oh, boy. Well, right now, my current project is really focused on email marketing. Because I believe that email is still the best ROI, the money that's most left on the table still is email.
100%
agree. Part of my product is I talk to people all the time. I talk to my customers a lot, and I still get this question all the time, guys. Hey, email, is that still really a thing? I mean, it's unbelievable. So many people that buy my product, they either have lists they've neglected or lists they don't mail at all, and they don't realize. I hate that phrase. It's like printing money. But that's the closest thing you can get to that hackneyed phrase of printing money, is by sending an email, making a good offer. It's still the most underutilized or underappreciated thing, not to you guys, I'm sure. But so anyway, that's kind of what I niche down to. I've kind of written everything from sales pages, landing pages, and all kinds of things. But that's kind of what my focus has been lately. But I also help people, businesses with their offers and funnels and copy in general. So.
Yeah, you told a story in one of your, I don't remember if it was in the sales letter or if it was just something else I was reading of yours. Because one thing people ask me, I know, because I've written some follow-up sequences and those kind of things, onboarding sequences. They're like, well, will this work for anybody, you know, any type of product? And you told a story about a guy who sold a medical product.
Yeah, it was wholesale drug urine cups. So yeah. This guy sold wholesale plastic cups that were sold to doctors and hospitals. And honestly, if this guy came to me before he bought my product, I might even, in that case, say, I don't know, give it a try. The product's got a guarantee. I'll be happy to refund you if it doesn't work.
Sure.
Yeah. Lo and behold, he goes, dude, I sent this email out. I got more responses back than I ever did before. People loved it. They want more. And so you saw the email I sent out to encourage people on my list. Like, look, if you think this doesn't apply to your niche, I don't care if it's e-commerce, your mortgage broker, whatever it is, stories resonate, email still works. If this guy can help sell wholesale drug urine cups, then this will work for you too.
That's amazing.
That's the best testimonial I got.
Yeah. So like, let's start breaking that down. Cause I think that's going to be hard for people to wrap their head around. How do you take just any given story? You know, I mean, you sit down, you've got to write your stuff. So this kind of goes back to the out of thin air thing. Mm-hmm. Like you're at your computer, you're at your keyboard. You need to write an email to drum up some business, drum up some sales, communicate with your customers, prospects. What's the process? Like how do you go through that?
Well, in that case, first of all, if you're selling a conventional product, or let's say a service, let's say you're a life coach, your business is transformation. That's a lot easier because you can tell stories about your clients and your own journey. Mm-hmm. If you're selling wholesale drug urine cups, obviously you're not going to talk about how it's transforming the lives of the purchase buyer at you know, Overlake Hospital.
Yeah. So let's go more kind of B2B, more like just regular. Jonathan is in industrial sales. So that's kind of his world. Because I think it's easier to kind of see how you could take that and apply it to life coaching or business marketing or anything like that.
Yeah, because
so let's go the more difficult route.
Anything that's a commodity, I mean, like you said, I mean, those, you know, cups, that's a commodity for the most part. People are like, okay, how do you separate yourself from any other manufacturer out there that's doing that? Well, you know,
because I mean, the first thought would be, well, how do I tell a story about a drug urine cup, right?
Well, that's the thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Pick up there.
Well, I was just going to say in that case, you wouldn't be telling a story about your commodity. Mm-hmm. You would tell a story about yourself. You basically want people to open your emails because they find you a cool or entertaining person.
Sure.
That's the whole goal of emails. You want to establish that bond so that they go, hey, when I get a message, when I get an email from Jonathan or Sean, I'm going to open that email, and not just because his last name happens to be McCool. So you can tell stories about yourself so that you become a character of sorts.
Yeah.
And then that you kind of slide in you go in the side door that way. Another way is if you're a commodity, I don't care how boring you think your commodity is, show us how the sausage is made. You know, you guys are both familiar with the story of Schlitz back in the early 1900s, where they were the first, they went from 18th to fourth place in the beer market because they just started telling people how the beer was brewed. And all the other brewers were like, what are you talking about? Everybody does this. It's boring. Yeah. You're not boring everybody else. You describe those dripping vats and the glass coolers and all of a sudden it's fascinating. So almost any product can be made fascinating. I think one of my customers sells welcome mats from Indonesia or something. And then he showed me pictures of the factory that makes them. And they were kind of cool to look at. You could tell a story about that, about how a product is made. So you don't necessarily have to make it about how, you know, if you're selling coffee mugs, you're not going to tell a story about how a coffee mug changed somebody's life. It's not going to resonate.
And I think there's a lot of people that would argue that point. I mean, I guess it's more the coffee than the coffee mug, but yeah, that's a good point. So you can either talk about kind of things that are just going on. So I think where people struggle with this, Bill, is the segue. Like, you've got a story and knowing how do I get from here to my product without it being weird, right? I mean, I've got my answers for that, but I'm curious. Like, I think that's where a lot of people get hung up. And yeah, I'm just curious to hear your take on that. And would you agree with that?
I would. I'd actually be interested to hear your take on it because I don't have a lot to say, but I know the first thing you want to do is sometimes you can make a quick segue, but many times you can't. If you make it too quick, it's going to sound abrupt and weird.
Yeah.
And so that's the first rule of a segue is don't just slide too quickly into it. Maybe, sometimes it takes some finessing. It's hard for me to think of an example off the top of my head, but it's just, you know, a lot of this, as you know, copywriting is maybe just as much an art as a science. So I think I probably have a knack for segues and transitions, so it might be hard for me to explain, but that's the first thing I would say is that don't try and force it and don't try and do it too quickly.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I'd probably add that I think they get easier the more often you do them.
Yeah.
And I think you start to see, and same with writing stories, right? The more you write stories, the easier it is to spot stories out and about and around you. And the easier you do, the more you do those, the more you can segue anything to anything. Like, it's just, you know, it's kind of like when you hear newscasters and some sports commentators, they're really good at segues. Like, that's part of the, kind of part of the job, right? They got to transition from a fiery bus crash with school children on it to, like, you know, the weather, like, all those little transitions. Some of them are cheesy, but the fact is they do them, and some of them are smooth, some of them aren't. But the fact is, I think the more you do it, the easier it gets. One of my favorite ways to do it, and you can't use this all the time, but if you really get stuck, you just say, you know, this is where I need a fancy, you know, transition statement to talk about my product, and I don't have one today. So I'm just going to tell you about my product.
That's good. I like that.
And that's what I use, like, if I get just completely stuck. But yeah, I agree. Like, going back to what you said something earlier, we've said this 100 times on the show and I keep repeating it because I want people to get it. I think it was Dan Kennedy. I've got a sheet from Dan Kennedy, one of his three ring binders with, you know, 15th generation photocopy. So I think this is the quote based on what I can read from the photocopy. He says, people really only want two things. They want to be either entertained or entertained and encouraged that their current worldview is correct. Mm-hmm. And if you can entertain them or agree with their current worldview, not change it, agree with it, support it, reinforce it, you got them. And they'll open and read anything that you send them. So, you know, I think that's kind of the basis of the story, but then the segue. Yeah. I think it's just practice. I really do. And I agree. It's a lot of art to it. So I think you have to read a lot. People need to get on your email list and read kind of what you do and how you do it, and other good copywriters. You know, Ben Settle comes to mind. I was telling a friend of mine, I actually like your emails better than Ben Settle. Yeah. I know he's kind of your next state up neighbor. But like, I feel like yours are a little bit more everyday language, where Ben kind of gets out there sometimes with his special language and all this other stuff that he does. It's a little too cute sometimes, a little too over the top. So that's my opinion.
He's definitely got his own thing going on. Yeah. You know, one thing I do like about him is that in fact, one of the next emails I'm going to be sending out is about the Hemingway app, because I have so many mixed feelings about it. And he's one of those guys that probably thumbs his nose at it, as I do in many ways. And he is not afraid of writing long sentences using multisyllabic words that the Hemingway app would probably, you know, not like. But
You know, I worked with Clayton Makepeace a few times. I was lucky enough to work with him a few times. I don't know if you're familiar with him. In the financial and health space and things like that. And one phrase he said that just really resonated with me, he was like, a tactic known is a tactic blown. So even using the Hemingway app and trying to hit third grade reading level and all that kind of stuff, at some point it becomes a tactic and you lose some of the art and the voice and the other things, because you're trying so hard to hit the tactic that you might go against your own principles or things like that.
That's such a great point. In fact, that comes to mind now every time I use ellipses to break up sentences.
Yeah.
And you know, it just becomes, I know it's effective and I know you want people to keep scrolling. It does make it easier to read, but now when I see it, I'm jaded because I read copy all the time. It almost feels like Chinese water torture to me. I read a guy like Stefan Georgi, who I like a lot. He'll break up a single sentence and sentences into like four different ellipses, broken lines. And at some point, if too many people start doing that, I'd be the kind of person to look for a way to go in a different direction.
Sure.
Yeah. You can go with dashes. You just do three dashes instead of dots. It's funny. in my role, one of the roles I have right now with kind of running an agency, I had to review some copywriters' work. And one of the guys, like, literally put, I mean, the entire lead, you know, the first third of the document, he had an ellipse after every single sentence. And I was like, dude, you just can't, like, that's too much. Beyond too much. Like, you just have to, and, you know, I think the same thing can happen. You know how, like, I know I like to, you like to, my buddy Doberman Dan, I think you and he write a lot alike. I don't know if you know Doberman Dan.
I do. Yeah.
He and you, I think y'all write a lot alike, where you ask the reader questions and kind of play their side of the conversation for them. And even that, I think that's one of those things that also can get overdone if you, you know, if you overuse it. And it's just, yeah, it's always trying to balance this stuff and stick with the principle of, you know, talking like a conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like sometimes you have a serious conversation with your friends. Sometimes you have a ridiculous conversation with your friends. Sometimes it's short and choppy, and sometimes it's in depth and longer. Like, to me, that's, again, go back to the art.
Yep. I mean, anytime it starts seeming like copy to me, then my hackles get raised, the radar goes up. So to mix it up is a great idea. I don't want to fall into a format of where it's just so stylized that it becomes predictable.
Yeah, 100% agree. I've got somebody posted in one of the copywriting groups I'm in a really good example of, like, you know, short sentences, medium and long sentences, and how they kind of wove them all together and things like that. I'll have to find that and send it to you, but it was really well done. Cause they were kind of talking about the same thing, you know, with the, I don't know if it was Hemingway app in particular, but the third grade writing and short sentences, which is not always the case. It doesn't always require short sentences. It requires clarity.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what Mark Ford talked a lot about, the FK score. All that is based about clarity, not necessarily about length and things like that. So,
It doesn't like adverbs either.
Yeah. Neither does Stephen King. I think that's in his book on writing. He talks about getting rid of adverbs, and I agree, because they do tend to make your writing a little bit lazier.
Right. Yeah. What I want to do is, I'm reading this novel right now by Lucy Ellman. You guys aren't going to believe this if you never heard of this novel, but it's a 1,000-page novel consisting of one sentence.
Oh, wow. Wasn't there like a famous Russian novel like that as well?
I'm not aware of it. Anyway, I want to feed that thing to the Hemingway app and just blow it up.
Yeah. AI just says, I quit. Yep. I'm out. That'd be like the scene from War Games at the end of War Games, the movie from the 80s, because we have to get an 80s reference on every show. So, like, when he tries to play tic-tac-toe against himself, the computer, and he's like, the only way to win is not to play. Like, I feel like that's what Hemingway app would do if you put that in there. It'd be like, I'm out.
Yeah.
One sentence, 1,000 pages. That's incredible.
One sentence. So, and her technique is every sentence. Well, they're not. They're almost like sentences broken up by semicolons.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
The entire novel is, she says, the fact that, and then she'll go on, the fact that, the fact that, the fact that, and you keep waiting for the payoff. And in a weird way, she makes it work, because it's written in the voice of a Midwest housewife in Ohio who loves baking, but she's got real frustration. She goes on, the whole thing is basically a rant and a commentary on American life. It's compelling, even though it's, and you have to stop reading in the middle of a sentence, obviously, because you're not going to finish a 1,000-page novel in a day or even a week.
Sure.
Yeah. But I think she was determined. I was so fascinated by it. I looked up interviews on her, and, you know, I think she was looking to kind of bust the form, kind of like we talked before. You don't want to fall into any kind of one form.
Yeah. I would love to take that into a 10th grade English class and make them diagram that sentence.
Yeah.
Or make the teacher diagram it. If I could, I mean, if I could go back to Miss Freeman and say, hey, Miss Freeman, here's a sentence for you to diagram. So
do you have a writer that you kind of pull from it's one of your favorite to read? I mean, was it Stephen King? I mean, Grisham, I don't care.
You know what? I'm a Jonathan Franzen fan. Jonathan Franzen, Richard Ford, Jim Winterson, Saul Bellow, I liked back in the day.
So you read a lot of fiction then?
Yeah, not as much as I used to, but my 20s and 30s, I read a lot of fiction.
Yeah.
Okay.
So where do you, I mean, when you're, if you're coaching someone to who's writing emails or writing copy that really has a hard time developing stories just from everyday life and bringing those into their, you know, their marketing copy or their, you know, their emails. I mean, what do you tell them? How do you, where do you start?
Well, the where you start is training them how to notice them. Yeah. Because I guarantee you that anybody listening to this had at least 10 things happen to them yesterday that would have been a great story. I wrote a whole email on, I was loading the dishwasher and I literally said out loud to myself as my wife was sitting on the couch, I said it under my breath. I said, I am so annoyed by how my wife loads the dishwasher. And that's a story right there. Sure. I mean, that's, you know, there's tributaries you could go off and, but there's like 10 things that happen to somebody every day mm-hmm. that could make for a story, whether it's just a quick comment at Trader Joe's with the cashier who's having a bad day. And you said, like, my pet phrase that I use is like, boy, it never stops, does it? And then she looks at you like, oh my God, you acknowledged how I feel. Nobody ever does that. Thank you. That's a story right there. I was in a store once where a guy refused to take off his mask. And this employee who, she was a woman in her 60s. You could tell she had a bad day. She struggled with this guy. She had to get security. And, you know, that's a story. There's just, anyway, so I have a little system where I have a spreadsheet. And at the end of every day, I take 5 minutes and I think back on my day and I'm like, what's the most story-worthy moment from this day? Is there anything there? Mm-hmm. And you do, if you train yourself to do this for a while, and it can only take 5 minutes a day, after a while, you'll get better at recognizing stories that happen during the day.
Sure.
So that's where you start. But the, you know, another part is of the equation is getting over the fear of putting that in an email. And honestly, I'm used to writing for clients and now I'm writing for myself now. So when I sat down to write that email about loading the dishwasher, being annoyed at my wife, who's the sweetest person in the world, and the dishwasher is not an issue, but in that moment, I sure was annoyed. You know, I had to get over a little bit of a fear of putting myself out there as somebody who's writing an email about his wife. I mean, that's not everybody wants to do that.
Yeah, I think a good example kinda of this, depending on how you grew up, pastors, I think, do this really well.
Yep.
Right, they pull little stories from their life. I think they do that really well. But I'm curious, Bill, because this is something I've struggled with.